Hi, it's Tom Gelton, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Great to be back with you. On my mind this week, the continuing battle over teacher pay and school funding. Protests spread to Arizona and Colorado, where some lawmakers threatened to jail striking educators. I talked to Dana Goldstein of the New York Times, who says for many, the economic realities of teaching have long felt unsustainable.
There's really an image of the teacher as middle class, but the teachers are feeling more working class and even working poor.
Then the three biggest providers of psychiatric care in the U.S. are not hospitals or clinics, but jails. We hear from the author of a new book, Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. First, I caught up with Arizona teacher Melissa England on her way to Thursday's walkout. She teaches social studies at Sundown Mountain High School in Surprise, Arizona. Melissa England, thanks for joining us for On My Mind. If today were a normal day, you'd be in school. What are your plans today?
Well, I'm definitely not staying home. We like to say today's not a day off. It's a day of action. And so I am getting ready to take myself and my children and to join my colleagues. And we're going to go downtown for the Red for Ed March for Education. You know, we've done walk-ins where we stand in front of our schools before school and then all walk in together. We've been doing stand-ups at the corners, and now we're going to walk to the Capitol today.
So you call your movement Red for Ed. Tell us about that.
I think it started early March on Facebook. There was a bunch of buzz one weekend or over the weekend, wear red on Wednesday. You know, wear red on Wednesday to talk about the crisis in education in Arizona. We are 50th in teacher pay, and we're the bottom five in per pupil funding. We're reaching crisis levels, so let's wear red to draw attention to this. And so I am, and several of my colleagues, you know, we wore red and this and that. And we had such a big turnout that first day. Like, it was really crazy. There were people posting red, like, everywhere. And I went to the grocery store, and I'd see people wearing red, and we'd give each other thumbs up. And it was really cool, like, people getting excited about drawing attention to the issue. And so then we did it the next Wednesday, and then the next Wednesday, and people are forming these Facebook groups, and they're talking about what's the next step. So we did this. We've got people involved. We've got people talking. You know, what do we do next? Instead of just sitting and waiting and saying, okay, no raise again this year. Okay, you know, we get a little bit of a raise, but our benefits go up too. You know, okay, there's no money to replace the computers in the computer lab, so we won't be able to use that this year. And okay, there's no assistant principal, so don't write a lot of referrals because they'll never get taken care of. And, you know, all the other issues we just have just been dealing with, you know, throughout the last 10 years, instead of just complaining about it, we feel like we're doing something about it.
And how long have you been teaching, Melissa?
This is my 21st year of teaching.
And what's been your experience over that time in terms of the support that you feel that you have gotten as a teacher?
So I took a job, and it was not very good pay even then in 1997. But every year I got a raise, and I got a decent raise. And for a couple of years I got some really good raises because the economy was just booming out here. And the growth was phenomenal. We were building in my district, you know, sometimes more than one or two schools a year. Like, we were growing so much. And so my salary was increasing all the time. And so I was hopeful that things were getting better. And then the recession hit a decade ago, and things kind of froze, and you kind of deal with it. You're like, okay, we can, everyone's going through tough times. We'll just kind of hunker down and deal with it. But as things have improved, we have not improved. So over the last 10 years, although I have gotten some raises on my contract, benefits have gone up. My retirement has gone up. The cost of living has gone up. But my salary has essentially stayed the same. And that means that, in fact, I take home less money than I did a decade ago in my paychecks.
And how serious is that issue of teacher pay when it comes to, you know, attracting new teachers to the profession, for example?
You know, that is one of the biggest reasons that I'm marching, because I hear stories and I've seen instances where a classroom will go through, you know, will have a teacher quit or, you know, won't be able to find a teacher when school starts. So the schools are faced with issues, you know, do we have over 40 in a classroom, or do we hire a sub and hope that we're able to find someone? And then the subs quit, or, you know, and so they go through multiple teachers throughout the year. And you know that those students are not getting a quality education. And it's not just my district, it's all the districts going through not being able to find teachers. You know, my friend is a former teacher, now she's an assistant principal, and she was telling me 10 years ago, they might have like 10 to 15 applicants for a position 10 years ago for like Spanish teachers or English teachers, and now, you know, they're lucky if they get two. And a lot of times there's no applicants at all, like for math teachers and special ed teachers and the hard to fill positions, they might not have any applicants at all.
And obviously in that situation, you're not going to be getting the same quality of applicants that you normally would.
Yes, and that's correct. So you can't be picky, and you get stuck with the warm body scenario. Do we take someone that's not ideal, but they will at least be able to take a classroom full of children so that we don't have 40, 50, whatever in the other classes? And that's not quality education. People want to raise the quality of education. Well, you can't do that when you can't draw good applicants.
What kind of reaction are you getting from your governor and your state legislators?
The governor at first, you know, called this all politics and kind of scoffed at it, I felt like at first. And then a couple of days after he did that on one of the news shows, he came out with his 20 by 2020 plan. And the 20 by 20 plan was not a real plan by anyone that really looks at the issue. It was not sustainable funding. While it might have worked for 1 year, there was no promise it was going to work any longer than that. The projected revenue for his plan was overly optimistic, and even other Republicans at the state level agreed that the projected revenue was overly optimistic. In order to give us those raises, he was going to cut programs for poor children's health care, disabled adults, veterans, and things like that. And it did not in any significant way address our overall funding, which is for the kids. So if we had taken the governor's plan, it would have hurt other people. It would not have necessarily solved anything long term. And it would not have helped the children, which is what, you know, the biggest issue here. It would not have made any significant difference in the per pupil funding. And it also wouldn't have helped any of our paraprofessionals or counselors. You know, the non-teacher professionals that I work with every day would not have gotten a raise either.
Would you have become a teacher again if you had to do all over again?
I have to say at this point, I don't think so. If you had asked me, you know, 10 years ago, I would have said yes. And I still do love teaching. I have absolutely nothing negative to say about my students or the profession, but I have seen a declining respect for teachers. I've seen obviously declining funding, but you know, there's a lot of, you know, finger pointing at teachers. You know, you don't do a good enough job, you take the summers off, and all this negativity about teachers. But at the same time, they don't want to do anything to help us raise the bar in the profession. And that does take money. You're not going to draw in the top people when the salary looks the way it is, and when the funding is the way it is, because it's not just, I want to make clear, the Red for Ed movement is not just about salary. Of course, that is the one thing that I guess people are talking the most about, but it really is about the per pupil funding and the funding for education in general.
Melissa England, a high school social studies teacher at Sundown Mountain High School in Surprise, Arizona. Melissa, thanks for sharing your story with us.
You're welcome.
Now let's hear from Dana Goldstein. She's been covering teacher protests since they started 2 months ago in West Virginia. Dana Goldstein is national correspondent for the New York Times. She's the author as well of The Teacher Wars. Hello, Dana.
Hi, thanks for having me, Tom.
So review for us where these teacher protests are happening around the country. We just heard about the situation in Arizona. Where all have they happened?
So the movement kicked off earlier this year in West Virginia. It spread to Oklahoma, where there was a 9-day walkout, then to Kentucky, where there were sort of scattered protests and walkouts across the state. And now we're seeing it in Arizona and Colorado. So this is the, let's see, one, two, three, it's the five states now that have experienced this.
And with the exception of Colorado, which is kind of a purple state, these other states are all conservative red states. What correlation is there between the fact that these walkouts are happening in largely conservative states?
I think the big trend across those four states that are red, Republican-dominated states is that when the recession occurred in 2008-2009, they really cut taxes very aggressively, which led to school budget cuts. Now, school budget cuts don't just impact teachers and their salaries, but also things that parents and kids notice, like the age of textbooks, or whether the building itself is in disrepair. Now, what happened is the past few years, as the economy has strengthened, these states have not gone back and replenished those tax revenues. So in many of these states, there have been corporate tax cuts or income tax cuts. And really, teachers and parents are saying, you know, enough pain. We've sacrificed and the economy is doing better now. So how come we're not experiencing any improvements in either our standard of living for teachers or in the actual resources available for students in the classroom?
And is the situation that much better in other states, the states that have not so far had these teacher protests?
Well, I think across the United States, we see huge disparities in per pupil funding. So some states are hovering around, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, and in other states, it could be closer to $20,000. So what I've been saying is I don't think we have necessarily a nationwide school financing crisis, but certainly we have a targeted one. And these states are states where it does seem to be a very big problem.
And remind us how bad the situation is in these states. What is the situation for teachers in these states where they are walking out?
So we see median teacher pay could be about $46,000, $47,000 in those states. But remember, that's the median. So, you know, at least half of the teachers are going to be making less. And what teachers are saying is that the starting salaries are so much lower. So you could see a starting salary of $28,000, $29,000, and it can take a very, very long time to build up to, say, $50,000. And this movement is largely driven by younger teachers in their 20s and 30s. They're making a lot closer to $30,000 a year than they are to, say, $50,000 a year. But many of them, they have children, they may have a few children, and they're saying, I just can't support a middle-class family life on this amount of money.
And of course, in almost all these cases, particularly with younger teachers who have entered the profession recently, they've had to go to college. They've all have four-year degrees.
Yeah, they have at least four-year degrees, and many of them have master's degrees as well. You know, I regularly out on the road in these states are interviewing teachers with $30,000 or more in student debt. Thank you for mentioning that. That's a very big piece of the problem here.
And why would people go into teaching? Why do? What have you found about why? I mean, you've written your book, The Teacher Wars. You've interviewed many, many teachers over the years. Why do people go into teaching when the pay is so low?
Almost all of the protesting teachers I've interviewed tell me how much they love their jobs, how passionate they are about working with students. Lots of them have been fantasizing about being teachers since they were young kids in classrooms themselves. This is, for many of them, the only job they ever really thought about doing or all they've ever done. So teachers choose their profession knowing that it's not highly paid. But I think where the disconnect is they did expect to be able to own a home. They did expect to be able to save for retirement. They did expect to be able to take a vacation. And what they're finding is that the salaries are so stagnant that they can't afford to do any of those things. So there's really an image of the teacher as middle class, but the teachers are feeling more working class and even working poor.
And unlike other working poor, many teachers, according to what you've written and what I've seen as well, actually pay out of their own pocket for school supplies and so forth. I mean, they take on expenses that people working in other low-income jobs wouldn't even think about doing.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And we've seen some really moving stories. Thousands of teachers across the country have sent us photos here at the New York Times of the supplies they've purchased for their classrooms or the extra money that they have spent. And I hear the stories every day. You know, one teacher whose classroom I visited was buying graph paper for her students. This is a math class, and her school wasn't even able to provide that. There are places where, in order to get chairs for the kids, the teachers are raising money from private donors, and they're taking their own time to do that, and sometimes their own money as well.
So these protests so far have had mixed results, but in most cases, they seem to be making an impression. And in several cases that you've written about, they actually have succeeded in bringing about some extra funding.
Yes, I would say that in all of the states so far where teachers have walked out, they have gotten at least some concessions from Republican lawmakers. So in West Virginia, the teachers have got a $2,000 raise. In Oklahoma, a $6,000 raise. In Kentucky, the teachers were demanding that the legislature override the governor's veto of the budget for the state, and they successfully achieved that. So now we'll have to see what happens in Arizona and Colorado, if the lawmakers there will similarly give something to teachers. Now, in Arizona, the governor has already offered a plan for a 20% raise for teachers, but the teachers have rejected that. They don't trust that plan because Governor Doug Ducey, a Republican, has said that he can offer a raise without raising taxes. And a lot of people on both sides of the aisle have looked at that and said it's simply fuzzy math. It doesn't add up.
Now, a lot of these states, as we've been saying, are conservative. And if I'm not mistaken, in almost all of them, if not all of them, strikes are prohibited and union membership is optional, right? So how...
That's right.
So how have these teachers managed to pull this off if they can't organize, you know, through their union and if they can't actually call it a strike?
Right. So Colorado is a little bit different, but talking about Arizona, Oklahoma, Kentucky, and West Virginia, union membership is optional in those states, known as right-to-work states, but there still are unions. So basically, the way this movement got started was from rank-and-file ordinary teachers, not union activists, who organize on Facebook. So there's been a lot of negativity about Facebook recently, some bad news for the company, but this is actually a case where Facebook worked really well for these teachers. They used it to organize themselves, and from there, the unions saw what the teachers were doing, and they sort of raced to catch up to these rank-and-file teachers and started to help them, you know, print out the signs that they needed for their protests and give them the funding to hold large rallies and offer their political expertise and how to lobby legislators. So what we're seeing at this stage of the movement is a partnership between these rank-and-file teachers and the unions.
And to what extent are the teachers supported by their colleagues? I mean, are you talking about sort of unanimous or near unanimous support on the part of teachers in these states for these movements?
It's definitely more than half of teachers that support this movement. I think in Arizona, I have noticed that teachers there are a bit more divided than in the other states I've covered. The vote showed that 78% of people who bothered to vote supported a walkout. But anecdotally, I have about five or six teachers across Arizona who I've been touching base with over the course of the last several weeks, and several of them did not support the idea of a lockout because they felt that the governor had put a pretty credible proposal on the table, and they didn't think that striking was going to add a lot to teachers' negotiating position. So I think that Governor Ducey, having observed what happened in these other states, made a smart political move by offering something. Even if it's not the offer that teachers were hoping for, or maybe that Democrats were hoping for, it is an offer. So it's a bit of a stalemate there in Arizona now, and it'll be interesting to see how it resolves.
And what about public support for these teacher movements?
The interesting thing was that in Oklahoma, there were a few polls that were run during the walkout. And even though parents were hugely inconvenienced by it because their young children's schools were shut down and they still had to go to work, so they had to figure out childcare for the day. And of course, many kids eat subsidized or free meals at school, especially poor children. So that's another concern. Parents overwhelmingly supported the Oklahoma teachers. And interestingly, we know from opinion polling in Wisconsin and in Chicago, where over the past 10 years, there have been some teacher union actions, parents do overwhelmingly get in line to support their kids' teachers when they do decide to make a political protest like this. So Arizona will have to see if that trend will hold true. It is not a state with a big history of teacher labor organizing. They've never had a statewide teacher walkout or strike in Arizona. That's different from Oklahoma or West Virginia, where in 1990, teachers in both those states were on strike. So this is all new for Arizona.
So given that these are the consequences of budget cutting and tax cuts that has reduced that have reduced revenue, what broader ramifications do you see developing politically around these teacher protests? Is it going beyond questions of school funding to raise issues about the wisdom of massive tax cutting and budget cutting?
Yes, I think it is going beyond. And what we're seeing in Arizona is that the teachers have asked not only for a raise for themselves and for support staff, and not only for new funding for education for children, but they have said no new tax cuts. So that's a very big demand, especially in a state like Arizona, where politicians have kind of raced to be the ones offering tax relief. So we'll see how that changes, maybe even potentially some midterm races. I mean, my colleague Alexander Burns and I here at the New York Times have written about how some Republicans are starting to move to the center on taxes and say we need to have space in the Republican Party for, you know, sensible policies that would allow us to fund our schools and keep pace with inflation at the very least when funding our schools. Certainly, I'd say that's still a minority of Republicans in these states. The majority of Republicans in these states remain, I think, very committed to the idea that you just want to reduce government size at all costs and continue to cut taxes.
You quote Gary Jones, a former chairman of the Republican Party in Oklahoma and a candidate for governor in Oklahoma, Republican candidate for governor, who is himself questioning the wisdom of all this tax cutting that has taken place.
Exactly. And he's an example of the type of Republican who's maybe introducing a new way to talk about it. And I mean, this is not historically new. It's just new maybe since the Tea Party revolt of the year 2010 or so.
Now, another issue that you mentioned that I find interesting is the connection with the charter school movement and privatization of schools. You write that this has actually hurt school enrollment and therefore indirectly hurt school funding.
Right. So in Arizona, which has really been a wild west for charter schools and for vouchers that allow parents to use tax money to send their kids to private schools, you know, some districts and schools have seen a loss of students to these other options. Now, when you have fewer students, you have less money in your school, and that may be okay in some regards because you have less money to spend on kids that you don't have. But there are some costs that remain the same, even if your student population goes down, say the cost of maintaining the building. So this is something that teachers are anxious about. And I've talked to, you know, traditional public school teachers in Arizona who say these charter schools and private schools are marketing themselves so heavily to parents. You know, we're doing a great job here at our public school, but parents have gotten the message that public schools are failing, and so they're not enrolling their kids.
So, Dana, what's the history here of teacher activism? I mean, teachers, as you pointed out, teachers have always been very, I think it's fair to say, very idealistic about their profession, their reasons for choosing their profession. But you've also written that the teachers have quite a history of activism when they feel that their interests are threatened.
That's right. I mean, the teacher union movement launched in 1897 in Chicago, and a big issue that motivated female teachers at that time to organize as a union was low corporate tax rates. The schools were just being starved while big companies at the time were paying very low taxes, especially property taxes at that time. So this is a thread that runs through American history. It is not new. And it's very interesting for me, having traced the history back to the late 19th century, to see this happening in 2018. I'll tell you, it is not the story that I expected to be covering this year.
And a lot of these teachers are women, of course, and I think you're right that the teacher union movement was largely directed, founded by women.
Yes, it was founded solely by women, and it was an explicitly feminist suffragist movement in the late 19th century. I think in the mid-20th century, the most famous union leader was Albert Schenker in New York City, and so that gave the teacher union movement a male face for a time in the 60s, 70s, 80s. But now, again, I mean, I think there's, because there's so much other feminist activism going on right now with the Me Too movement, people are talking about how, you know, this is a female profession. We do see that 75% of American teachers remain women to this day.
Back when the teacher movement got started, teachers were very, because it was largely a female profession almost entirely, the teachers were very poorly paid back at the beginning.
Right, that's right. Of course, over the long course of history, teacher pay has improved exponentially. I mean, teachers used to be paid akin to, say, like a housemaid in the 19th century. You know, because of collective bargaining and the big strides that were made in the 60s and 70s with many teacher strikes during that period, you know, the expectation came that, look, teaching was a middle class or an upper middle class profession. It requires a college degree, often a master's degree, and it should be paid accordingly. That said, if you look at teachers compared to other similarly educated workers, teachers are still far underpaid.
So what do you see as being the political implications of this, given that we are having midterm elections coming up? I'm sure that most of these, most of the debate must be around governor races or state legislature races. Do you see it spreading beyond to congressional races, for example?
Yeah, so my colleague Alexander Burns and I have looked at this. We think there's only about a half dozen congressional races that could be impacted by this, but we do really think that we will see this teacher movement impacting state legislatures and governor races. I mean, really, this is a very big challenge for the Republican Party, given how sympathetic parents are to teachers and to the idea that their own children's schools should have more money to spend. I was out in Arizona with parents that were protesting alongside their children's teachers, and I did not know what to expect. I started going down the line of parents, typically mothers, asking them, you know, how they were planning to vote, who they typically voted for. And three, four women I talked to in a row in suburban Phoenix told me that they were Republicans that were considering voting Democratic this year. So this could have a big impact.
So Dana Goldstein, you've said several times that this kind of caught you by surprise. This is not the story you expected to be covering in 2018, and yet you are the author of The Teacher Wars, and you've spent a long, big part of your career looking at teacher struggles.
You know, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised because I am a student of history, and history does typically repeat itself. So in that way, I'm not surprised. But in another way, I am, because I didn't necessarily expect for teachers to be the ones to rise up in 2018. But as I get into the issue and I really look at these particular states and just see that, you know, sometimes budgets have been cut by a total of, say, $1 billion since the recession. When you see that level of need, it's not that surprising that people are angry.
Dana Goldstein is a national correspondent for The New York Times and the author of The Teacher Wars. And her recent articles in The New York Times have been sort of a sequel to her book, The Teacher Wars. Dana, thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now a quick break. And we're back. Here's Alisa Roth. Alisa Roth, author of Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. Hello, Alisa.
Hello.
Let's start with your one-word title, insane. Now, that's a pretty loaded word. We don't use it much anymore to describe someone with mental illness, but I'm sure you've chosen that thoughtfully.
I really chose the word insane for the title because it was the best word to describe the systems that we're talking about, the mental health care system and the criminal justice system, and really what we as a society do to and expect from people with mental illness.
But let's talk about people with mental illness. What does it mean to be mentally ill?
It's interesting because when you start looking at the jails and prisons around the country, which of course we talk about the criminal justice system as this single entity, and it's not. It's thousands of small little entities. And each one really has a slightly different definition for what it means to have a mental illness. In the context of the book, I mostly mean people with what might be considered the big three, so bipolar disorder, major depression, and schizophrenia. In some systems, people will add on PTSD as one of those, and I think that's a legitimate addition. And then in some jails and prisons, they also include things like anxiety disorders, even ADHD.
Right. And how is it? I mean, your whole book is around this idea that people with mental illness are increasingly, or have in recent years, increasingly been treated through the criminal justice system. How has that developed?
Well, we have a story that we like to tell, and by we, I mean we, the media, and we, society, that talks about deinstitutionalization. So, and I'm sure this will be familiar to a lot of people, but back in the middle of the last century, the story goes, everybody with a mental illness was living in an institution. Those institutions were beautifully described and shown in the book and the movie One Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest. I think that's the image that many of us had. And that conditions deteriorated in those institutions to the point where we had to shut them down. We let out all the people who were living in them. They were no longer able to access the kind of mental health care that they needed. Without that treatment, their mental illness led them to commit crimes, which then got them arrested, landed them in jail and prison. And here we are with jails and prisons as the quote-unquote new asylums. So this is the story that we like to tell, and it's a neat story because it gives us a very clean solution to the problem. If people are committing crimes because of untreated mental illness, all we need to do is treat that mental illness, and people will no longer end up in the criminal justice system. I think that this crisis is really part of the larger conversation about mass incarceration. So we in this country lock up a tremendous number of people. There are more than 2 million people who are incarcerated in the United States right now. And in picking up so many people, we are also getting a large number who have mental illness.
And we end up putting them through the criminal justice system. And you write in your book that those institutions, jails and prisons, are not equipped to deal with people who have mental illness.
Jails and prisons were designed as penal institutions. They were designed to punish people, to separate people from society because they did something wrong. They are not therapeutic places. They're not equipped to treat mental illness.
And what are some of the sort of misfits that you see when you see mentally ill people in jails and prisons? What are some of the ways that, you know, that is manifested, that inability of those institutions to deal with the special needs of people with mental illness?
Jails and prisons are tough places to be even without a mental illness. They have large numbers of rules that are very strict and often seemingly at least capricious. They are set up in such a way that you have a small number of officers watching a large number of people. For people with mental illness, it is often very difficult to follow those rules. And then because it's a punitive environment, breaking the rules leads to more punishment, which then leads to breaking more rules. So a classic example of this is the use of solitary confinement. We've known for centuries that putting somebody in solitary confinement can make symptoms of mental illness worse, or in fact trigger symptoms of mental illness in somebody who hadn't shown those symptoms previously. It's a standard form of punishment in jails and prisons for a variety of reasons. It's widely used. I think something like 80,000 people are thought to be in solitary confinement on any given day in the United States. So when a person with mental illness breaks a rule, let's say, doesn't stand up when the prisoners are being counted because he or she doesn't understand that he's supposed to do that, or because the voices in his head is telling him that standing up is going to get him killed, or whatever the circumstances, that person gets put into solitary confinement as punishment. And then there are rules in solitary confinement. So you're not allowed to have more than X number of pencils in your cell, for example, or you need to stand up to retrieve your food tray. And so breaking those rules then gets the person in trouble again and often leads to more time in solitary confinement.
And one of the points that you mentioned, which is really important, is that sometimes people go into that system with conditions that could be treated on a short-term basis, and those conditions are so aggravated by their experience that they actually become chronically mentally ill and really have to stay there.
I've heard the term psychotogenic, meaning triggering of psychosis, mm-hmm. used to describe jails and prisons. Jails and prisons are disorienting. They're loud. They keep the lights on at all hours of the day and night. They wake you up. Sometimes I would look at these logs of prisoners, and you look at when they're doing pill call or meals or even outdoor time, and it's like they're bringing you lunch at 4 o'clock in the morning, or I guess it would be breakfast at 4 o'clock in the morning. Those kinds of things, we know, even living on the outside, are disorienting and disruptive. And so combine that with inadequate treatment, whether it's not enough medication or not enough therapy or just not enough to do. And it's really damaging environment for people.
You talk about a man you call Christopher Rodriguez, who you say went into the criminal justice system with mental illness in 2008. Tell that story.
Christopher Rodriguez developed mental illness when he was a teenager. Initially, his mother thought he was just devastated by the death of his grandmother, but in fact, he had schizophrenia. She had him hospitalized more times than she can count, against his will, occasionally with his agreement. He ended up in the criminal justice system, spent several years in jail, and was so sick while he was in jail that he was hospitalized twice for a psychiatric hospitalization and once because he injured himself so badly that he needed to go back to the hospital for an operation. He was moved finally to the state prison system in Florida, managed to spend a couple of months in general population before the prison officials figured out how sick he was. And this is common, that somebody will come in with an identified mental illness, having received treatment in the jail, but the communications are such and the separation of the systems is such that it may take a while for that person to get treatment or to figure out what treatment to give that person once they get to prison. And he has spent most of that time extremely psychotic, so not recognizing his mother, not wanting to see her. Often his mother will call to go visit, and the prison will say that he's too sick to receive visitors. I'm happy to report that I spoke to her recently, and as of last week, he seems to be doing a little bit better. But he has several months left in his sentence, and there's real concern about lasting damage that he may have gotten from all the time that he's spent being undertreated or not treated fully.
And speaking more generally about the number of the prevalence of mental illness in our penal system, you have some pretty impressive numbers in your book about how many inmates at these institutions have mental illness or are there because of things that they have done as a result of their mental illness.
About half of all people in jails and prisons are thought to have some form of mental illness.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. Here in New York, at Rikers Island, it's about 40%. About 11% are deemed to have what they call a serious mental illness.
And where were those people before? Were they on the street? Were they, you know, in society? Were they locked up in psychiatric hospitals? Because you do point out the percentage of inmates with mental illness has been increasing in recent years.
People with mental illness who end up in the criminal justice system, many have cycled back and forth between our mental health care system, so inpatient hospitalizations, which today rarely means institutionalization like what we saw in the 1950s, let's say, but short stays in a psychiatric hospital, say, or in a psychiatric ward of a general hospital. Many are homeless, but many are just regular people. There's a story I tell in my book of a man named Brian Sanderson, who had been a firefighter in Virginia. He'd left firefighting to start his own business, developed bipolar disorder, was hearing voices that told him he needed to go to Texas to open a homeless shelter. He was about halfway there in South Carolina when he ended up in a roadside motel, was riding the elevator in this motel up and down without wearing any clothes, and was arrested on charges of indecent exposure and ended up spending 6 months in jail in South Carolina. So people can come from anywhere. It's one of the disturbing and interesting parts of this story is that mental illness really strikes across all sorts of lines.
And, of course, whether those people have resources, family resources, support systems, whether they end up in a jurisdiction, perhaps with a record of treating people a little bit more thoughtfully, all of those are big differences, and differences that are exaggerated across income and racial lines, you argue.
So we talk a lot about the role of race in the criminal justice system, and we're starting to talk more about the role of poverty. And mental illness is really that third piece of it. So while somebody with mental illness may end up getting arrested anyway, somebody who is African American or Hispanic and somebody who's poor and somebody who has a mental illness is much more likely to get caught up in the system and to have more trouble getting out of the system once he or she ends up in it.
You write at the end of your book about somebody you went to high school with, whom you call Matthew, who did some pretty terrible things as a result of his mental illness, but has gotten pretty good treatment for that. And you credit it with basically the wealth of his family, his father, who really took it upon himself to make sure that he got the best treatment. It's not really a model that really would apply to a lot of people with mental illness, is it?
Across the criminal justice system, we see tremendous disparities in race and socioeconomic status, let's say. I was visiting Rikers Island one day and was chatting in line with a woman from Long Island, a white woman, upper middle class white woman whose son had been arrested on heroin charges. And I asked her if she had any sense of where her son's case was going or what was happening with it. And she said she wasn't sure, but that their attorney would be visiting him that day or the next, and they would know more after that. And with that one sentence, she had differentiated herself from 99.9% of the people in that line and her son from 99.9% of the people who were being held on the island. In an ideal world, we would be able to eliminate things like cash bail, which hold huge numbers of people in the criminal justice system because they simply can't afford to buy their way out while their case is being adjudicated. In the meantime, if we as a society can contemplate other alternatives and better alternatives for people with mental illness who end up in the criminal justice system. So does this person really need to be sitting in a jail cell for the next 2 years while his case works its way through the system? Or is there a way that we could have him treated in the community while we wait for that case? Or does that person's case really need to go into the criminal justice system at all? In Miami, there's a wonderful diversion program that's gotten thousands of people with mental illness out of jail and into treatment just by acknowledging upfront this person doesn't need to be in the criminal justice system.
So, Elise, I'm going to tell you a story about someone in my own family, a fairly close family member, very intelligent, very well-educated, upper class. She developed schizophrenia in her 20s, and it was almost impossible to know what to do with her because as a result of her schizophrenia, she was very suspicious of any kind of institution. She didn't want to take medication because she had delusions that somehow that, you know, someone was trying to poison her. And for almost any kind of treatment that you could come up with, she was able to sort of come up with some sort of paranoid delusion about that, and it made it really hard to you know, come up with a treatment for her. I'm wondering how common a situation like that might be.
Unfortunately, it's extremely common. And one of the things I heard over and over again from family members was that the laws that we put in place to protect people's civil liberties, so the civil liberties of people with mental illness, have at the same time made it extremely difficult for family and friends and even society as a whole to help somebody who may not be in a position to realize that they need help.
That's a real tension, isn't it?
It's a terrible tension because, of course, we want to protect people's civil liberties. At the same time, there are times when we say that somebody isn't in a place where they can make what would be considered the right decision. And it happens not just with mental illness. We see it with things like dementia. One thing that might ease things is that for a lot of people, there are so many barriers to getting mental health care early. And the data shows, particularly with something like schizophrenia, that early intervention can really, really make a difference in the outcome. But between the stigma of getting help and just the actual access to care in the community, if we could make it easier to get that care, maybe we could catch some of those cases before they reach the point where somebody's really refusing the help.
Some mentally ill people are dangers, if not to themselves, then to other people. I mean, you talk in your book about the character you call Kyle Muhammad, whose mother was devoted to him. And yet, as you write, several times she felt the need to call the police and have him taken away.
The problem is that we don't have any other place to call. If you call 911 in just about every city, county, state in this country and say that you have somebody who's in a mental health crisis, whether that person is threatening suicide or threatening homicide or simply acting inappropriately, the people who respond are going to be the police officers. In the case of Kyle Muhammad's mother, she never wanted to call the police. She just wanted to get treatment for her son. But she knew that the only way to get it was to call the police or to call 911, and then it would be the police who would respond. And we need to think about ways to either train the police, which many cities are doing, to better respond to people with mental illness, or to find ways, which again, cities are doing, to attach a mental health professional to the police so that when they respond to a mental health call, they have the support that they need. You know, in police training, we teach officers how to track down a suspect or how to shoot a gun or how to protect somebody in danger. We don't, for the most part, teach them how to respond to somebody who's in a mental health crisis.
So obviously the criminal justice system is not designed, set up, equipped to deal with mentally ill people very well. There's also the issue of the civil liberties of those people. Let's talk for a bit about what does work, what should work, what kind of system do you envision? On the basis of your research and your reporting, what is the answer?
A lot of cities have seen success with intensive training for law enforcement officers. Some experts have said to me that the kind of training that we're giving to officers to deal with people with mental illness is really just good training for police officers. It's training them how to de-escalate a situation, how to respond with kindness and compassion and to seek a way to help. And certainly many officers that I met want to do that, regardless of whether they've had the training or not. We're starting to see that training even among corrections officers in some jails and prisons, and that's helped them learn how to respond better. So then the next part is, if you train the police officers, you need to have a place for the police to then take that person, because otherwise jail becomes the quick and easy solution. So we've seen cities, San Antonio is the best example of this model of creating a crisis center. So someplace that's really set up to receive somebody who's in a mental health crisis. So when those police officers pick that person up they have some place to take them. They have some place to take them where you don't have to wait 6, 12, 18 hours, as one often has to do in an emergency room, and some place that's really equipped to take that person and then connect him or her to the services in the community. And then the third model that we've seen that works well is the diversion. So diversion out of the criminal justice system, either before they've even been charged with a crime, recognizing that this person has a mental illness, that this person doesn't need to be in the criminal justice system, that neither the person nor the system will be well served by having that person there, and finding ways, again, to connect that person to treatment and services in the community, or after they're charged, again, very quickly saying, this person shouldn't be here, this person doesn't need to be here, let's find someplace else.
Is anyone talking about reopening the psychiatric hospitals that we saw in the past, the ones that were closed, as you say, in the 50s and 60s?
The psychiatrists I've talked to agree that there is a very, very small proportion of people with mental illness who will never be able to live on their own and may need some kind of a longer-term therapeutic environment in which to live. The danger that we run is that we have already recreated in our jails and prisons the precise conditions that led us to close the asylums decades ago. So it's too many people being warehoused there, too many people getting too many medications and not enough other treatment, not enough staff to take care of them. Staff that in some or many cases even is underqualified for the task at hand, and effectively shutting them, as you said earlier, out of sight, out of mind. And so the danger as we talk about finding new ways of approaching this is, how do we find something else that doesn't just do it all over again? We get people out of jail and prison and put them back into an institution that then degenerates into the same kind of warehousing that we've already seen for decades.
Well, Alisa, you have identified a really significant problem here in our society that has not gotten the attention it needs. And your book, I'm sure, will make a contribution to discussion of this issue. Thanks for writing it, and thanks for sharing your experiences with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Natalie Yurev-Lifker, Danielle Brown, and Cliff Gallagher. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Jelton.